Well, welcome back from lunch. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Trevor Bernard. I'm a professor of history at Warwick, and for my sins, which may be many, well, definitely are many, some of which we found out, some of which have not, I'm director of the Yaesu Prasad Centre for Caribbean Studies. And it's a very great pleasure to introduce to you today our keynote speaker, Al Crichton. I should mention that Al is comes to us courtesy of support both from our centre, but also from the Institute of Advanced Studies, and the director of the Institute of Advanced Study, Hilary Marland, is here. So thank you very much, Hilary, for your support. Your support of this conference and particularly of this keynote lecture. Al is a distinguished scholar of Caribbean literature with a number of links to the University of Warwick. Indeed, he has been a visiting fellow at the Centre for Caribbean Studies at the University of Warwick, out of which came some important works, including one of the things, to my knowledge, a nice article in Callaloo on Wilson Harris. He has worked on a variety of West Indian literary giants. He's also himself a poet, playwright, theatre director, and perhaps one of his most important positions is as a long-serving literary and art critic attached to the Starbrook News in Georgetown, Guyana. As well as a distinguished and prolific academic career, Al also is a senior academic involved in extensive academic management. He is the Dean of the Faculty of Arts at the University of Ghana and also Deputy Vice-Chancellor at that institution. He's Secretary of the Management Council, which stands guard over the Ghana Prize for Literature, and knows, therefore, the literary background of the Caribbean, both as a practitioner, as an academic critic, and as an arts administrator. So there's no one really more qualified, I think, to talk about Indo-Caribbean literature than Al. And his title, which is slightly different from advertising, I'm reading it over his shoulder here, is Aspects of Indian Culture in the Caribbean, the Impact of Theatrical Traditions, Cultural Change, and Popular Culture. Al.
Thank you very much, Trevor. I tend to be a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more at ease if I deliver this thing standing up, but there's no lectern, so I'll try my best. thank you. Yes, I'm sorry, but I just tend to... Yeah, thank you, Trevor. And I feel very honored to have been asked to give this Roy Heath Memorial Lecture as the keynote speaker at this conference in Indo-Caribbean Literature and Culture. And as Trevor said, I have had quite an association with the Center for Caribbean Studies. And I fully appreciate having been given this opportunity to make some further contribution to research here. Now, Roy A.K. Heath, 1926 to 2008, in whose honor this lecture is presented, was among the first line of foremost Guyanese fiction writers. He was born in Guyana and moved to London in 1951, where he studied language, primarily French, and law, being called to the bar at Lincoln's Inn. But despite that long period of work in the United Kingdom, he has been described as an intensely Guyanese writer, since he never wrote about any other country or any other people. He produced 9 novels, winning the Guardian Fiction Prize for The Murderer in 1978. But I think his major achievement was another novel called The Shadow Bride, which won him the Guyana Prize for Fiction in 1989. Now, The Shadow Bride is a novel of epic proportions, interrogating the life of a woman struggling to be an independent individual in spite of the traditions of her culture and ethnic background. What is very significant and remarkably appropriate about this is that The Shadow Bride is an intensely probing and famously convincing account of the issues confronting an Indian woman. It is the work of a black man about an East Indian woman, which successfully overcome the barriers of both race and gender to enter the psyche of not only an East Indian, but an East Indian woman living in the Indian community of Georgetown in Guyana. This was an achievement of which Roy Heath himself was quite proud, and also which David Dabedin described as a major work in the rediscovery of Indians in Guyana. Now, indeed, the novel came, The Shadow Bride, came at a time when there was not yet the outflow of fiction about Indians in Guyana that there is now. Indian writers only began to write about the East Indian Guyanese experience, the social and political issues surrounding their existence in a country that has experienced racial tensions. They only began to pour that out, in fiction in particular, in the 1990s. And when Heath wrote in 1988, these kinds of novels had not yet emerged. And this was so, although writing in Guyana by Indians coming out of indentureship really began in Guyana in the late part of the 19th century. And one may wonder what had happened in all that period of time between the work of Joseph Rohoman and Peter Rohoman, C.E.J. Ramcharitar Lala, and a number of others, all the way up to the 1980s. Now, there is much that one could say about the Guyanese literature of Indian origin, but I will basically skip over all of that and come to the point that one of the factors that seemed to have affected the rise of Indian Guyanese literature had to do with the kind of political and cultural associations that developed in the early part of the 20th century, in the middle part of the 20th century. If one goes back to Rohoman's publication, which he called, the very long title, I hope I can remember it, To India, it's a very long title, so I'm trying to find it. To India.
Alan,
yeah.
I remember the title because I republished something.
Yeah.
It's called India and the Progress of Our People Abroad. At Home and Abroad, and How Those in British Guyana May Improve Themselves.
Yes. Improve themselves. And one notes that Rohoman was more concerned with India than with British Guyana. The British Guyanese are not described as British Guyanese, but they are described as the people of India abroad. So that Rohoman was looking at the people of Mother India. And even after Rohoman, what concerned the several cultural organizations that developed in Guyana was Indian culture, as in culture from the subcontinent of India. And while there was a very strong development of Indian cultural consciousness in Guyana, where Indians began to take pride in Indian culture, it was largely looking across to the continent rather than looking into what was taking place in Guyana at the time. Now, one could make several other pertinent comments about the literature, but my focus in this lecture is on the theatrical traditions in Indian culture in the Caribbean, their social impact, the effect of cultural change and the popular culture. Now, there exist in the Caribbean, in Trinidad and Guyana, and to a lesser extent in Jamaica, a number of traditional Indian festivals, religious festivals and religious traditions. And one observation is that most, the vast majority of the traditional practices that one finds in the Caribbean of Indian origin are based on religion. They are either themselves religious traditions or they are offshoots of religious belief and religious practice. They are based on social practice and mythology. And at the center of large religious festivals are sacred devotion, spiritual teachings and engagements, pujas and rituals that take place only among the devotees. But a common characteristic of the major festivals is that they are driven by teachings about the religion, the communication of messages which carry the principles upon which the belief is built. These messages transcend what takes place among devotees and have a public outreach, in that each festival has public exhibitions which reach out to the participation of non-believers, and these have had some effect on the popular culture. Now, another characteristic of the festivals is their use of dramatization and theatrical devices in the public outreach and exhibitions. There is a widespread use of symbolism, myth, drama, theatrical spectacle, and the carnivalesque. One example is the Hindu festival of Pagwa. And before going on, I might just mention, I have had some experiences with research in these areas and in making presentations about this research. I can recall, for example, which is what I mentioned, the fact that most of these traditions, particularly the folk traditions, and even those that are not folk traditions, are so steeped in religion that sometimes one gets into trouble talking about them in public, as I did in the past, where in talking about some of these folk practices and being roundly abused by pandits who could not understand a kind of objective, non-religious investigation of these practices. One pandit told me that I had no right to call the name of Lord Rama. Right? Among some of the folk practices that I was dealing with, that I was researching, that I was basically desecrating the religion and mixing Lord Ram with all kinds of vulgarities. And Rawan. So that those are some of the things, and I'm saying that even though they are based in religion, there are a couple of aspects that I will mention, including a tension between Orthodox Hinduism and some of these folk practices. Now, one may examine the Hindu festival of Pagwa, otherwise called Holi, and look at the story of Prahalad, which is central to the celebration and important to the Hindu religion. Pagwa is a dramatization of faith, obedience, miracle, virtue rewarded, pride punished, and of sacrifice. Prince Prahalad's father, Hiranyakashipu, and I have seen variations in the name of this king, but I will stick with Hiranyakashipu, was a powerful king who had powers given to him as a boon by the gods. This seemed to have caused him to become very self-important, and he banished belief in God, commanding all in the kingdom to worship him. But his son Prahalad refused, insisting that he would worship only God. The king decided to make an example of him. King Hiranya's sister, Holika, also had powers because she could not be burnt by fire. And so the king built a large blazing pyre, and Holika took hold of the boy and put him to sit on her lap in the middle of the engulfing flames. But Prahlad was saved by a miracle, since unexpectedly, Holika was burned to ashes and he came out unscathed. Now, this salvation was a reward to the boy for his faith and sacrifice, while Holika was punished by having her gift of immunity revoked. It was taken away from her and given to her nephew at that moment when she took him in the fire. As far as the king is concerned, his boon was that he could not be killed by day or by night, not by man nor beast, neither indoors nor outdoors, neither on the ground nor in the air. And of course, this meant that he was downright invincible. But his gift was turned into a weapon of self-destruction, and virtue turned into vice, because since he was given a false sense of security, feeling that he could not die, there was nothing that could kill him. And he used this false sense of security to live in his pride until he was outwitted and killed. He was eventually killed by a masquerader in an appropriate irony. He was killed by one dressed in a costume, so that this costume made his conqueror neither man nor beast. He was killed at dusk, when evening was turning into night, so it was neither night nor day. He was killed in the door frame, right? So it was neither indoors nor outdoors. He was killed on a balcony, so it was neither on the ground nor in the air. And so all of those were used to confound the assurance that he was given that he could never be killed in any of those conditions. But the king was given his comeuppance for his pride. Now, the dramatization of this tale in Pagua festival is the use of public theatrical spectacle and symbol. The spring festival of rebirth. It's a celebration, and the dyes, the abir, the powder, the color are symbolic and represent the scattering of Holika's ashes. It is also a celebration of the triumph of good over evil. And yet another symbol is the burning of Holika, done through the lighting of a grand pyre. Now, one of the points I'm making is the kind of closeness of these traditions and festivals to the use of dramatization and a very profound form of literariness that one can find in the techniques used in these traditions and the stories and the myths on which they are based. Now, take Diwali or Deepavali, the Festival of Lights, which is another example of dramatization and theater. Now, it is a devotion to Lakshmi, goddess of light. And in fact, the word Deepavali means rose of Diyas. And these are lit to invite the goddess into the homes and the hearts of the devotees. Now, these lights are both symbolism and public spectacle, and a part of the outreach of this religious festival. But the story of Lord Ram, the God King, is also dramatized. The lights are symbols of Ram's triumphant return to Ayodhya, of good prevailing over evil, light over darkness, enlightenment over ignorance, and Ram over Ravan. Now, Ram returned from exile on the darkest night of the year to a grand popular celebration, and the lighting of diyas on Diwali night plays out that return, when the people lit them and strung them out to guide his way and welcome him, since the night was so dark. The exhibition of light is the public spectacle and outreach which the population outside of Hinduism find attractive. Remember, I am saying that these religious festivals have their devotion, their sacred pujas and practices within. But they also have a very important element of public outreach, which involves the participation of several who are not themselves Hindus, and of several who might have no belief or interest at all in Hinduism. There is also the carnivalesque, because in Guyana, the grandeur of lights is greatly enhanced by the motorcade, which is a large and spectacular street parade in which vehicles are decorated with lights or are used to carry tableau images and costumes, human models depicting scenes involving several other gods and religious images. Now, this reminds me again of another experience in the thing. I once wrote something for publication which said that these Hindu festivals make use of the carnivalesque. The editor took it out. And there was a fear that by associating sacred Hindu traditional practices with the carnivalesque would again be some kind of violence done to the sacredness of this religion by associating it with carnival. But carnivalesque is merely a technical term to describe the kind of performance, the kind of technical display and exhibition that takes place. And I will say more about this. The whole thing about masks and masking, the whole thing about building costumes and about parading down the street in a public display, which is a part of the outreach, the public outreach of these festivals, and which have nothing to do with profanity. Now, this is exceedingly popular. I'm talking here now about the display of lights in the Pauli, and in Guyana, the grand motorcade that takes place. It is exceedingly popular and attracts tens of thousands of spectators along the streets. Apart from Mashamani or Carnival, no other event has greater participation from the public, who line the route for more than 6 miles to make it the most spectacular festival in Guyana. The street parade ends with a public concert in a park, and no other religious festival has greater popular impact, with an audience that includes several thousands non-Hindus who might have no other contact with the religion. Another event has much less public impact, much less, it doesn't have anything comparable to the public impact of Diwali, but it is one of the most amazing, remarkable, and significant achievements in West Indian folk theater. And I'm talking here about the Ram Leela, which is the deliberate performance of a dance drama, an overt, direct dramatization of the story of Ram, unlike the Diwali or other traditions, which are more subtle and symbolic. It is yet another public outreach of the Hindu religion, conveying messages, instructing people, propagating the religion, its values and principles, putting forward Ram and Sita as exemplary. One important difference between this and Diwali or Pagwa, however, seems to be in the intended audience. It does not seem to have been designed for non-believers, but more for an audience of Hindus, so that the Ram Leela, despite its grand spectacle and public performance, was actually designed for Hindus, as a teaching tool for Hindus. Of all the Caribbean territories to which this tradition was brought by the indentured immigrants from North India, it has best survived in Trinidad, where it is still vibrant as an annual event in the villages west of Chaguanas in central Trinidad, a number of villages, including Felicity and a few others in that area, plus a few other villages further south in Trinidad. The Ram Leela, or Ram Dilla, as the villagers call it. Villagers call it Ram Dilla. The play is performed with the reading of a narrative, while elaborately and colorfully costumed actors mime and dance the story. Leela means play, so the Ram Leela is Ram's play. But it is the longest play on earth, lasting lasting some 40 hours and taking 9 or 10 days to be performed. Imagine going to see a play, coming back for 9 or 10 days to see each act. More than 40 hours of performance to be performed. And the villagers meet to do this on a large field. It is an outdoor performance, setting the stage and playing outdoors. Ram is the reincarnation of Lord Vishnu, who in answer to a plea for help to rid the world of evil, decided to be reborn as Prince Ram, son of King Dashrath and Queen Kaushalya in Ayodhya. Excuse my pronunciation. Right? The king and queen in Ayodhya. The story is long and complex, but the main plot of the play is centered on the exile of Ram from the kingdom, the adventures of his wife Sita and brother Lakshman, who go with him into the forest. The main action surrounds the abduction of Sita by Ravan, the demon king of Lanka, and the great battle waged by Ram with the help of Hanuman to defeat Ravan and rescue Sita. It ends with Ram's return to accept the throne of Ayodhya, and this whole story is acted out. This performance has a significant irony. It was originally done for the benefit of village people in India who either could not read or did not have the opportunity to read the Ramayana from which the story is taken. In fact, the script used for the performance is taken from the work of the saintly Govinda Tulsidas, who was born in 1543, a poet and philosopher of Uttar Pradesh, who, although he was a scholar of Sanskrit, wrote in dialects of Hindi so that the populace could understand what he was writing and so that the populace could understand the holy scriptures. He wrote Ram's story in verse in the epic, and here again one of these lengthy names, in the epic Ramacharita Manasa, right? Which means the lake of the deeds of Ram. But this was his translation from the original work in Sanskrit, the famous Ramayana by Valmiki. Yet, despite this assumption of simplicity, and the production is a massive narrative from that text, spoken with performance, dance, mime, acting, and masking in what is an extremely difficult task, staging 40 hours of text. It is a great feat in theater done by amateurs, villagers untrained, and some of them uneducated. This dramatic achievement makes use of grand spectacle, brilliantly colorful costuming, effigies, building of costumes, carnival style, including a giant replica of Ravan, more than 20 feet high, which is burnt at the end of the play. It is symbolic and spectacular, and done in the form of the carnivalesque, with costumes, masks, masquerade, stick fight, and a street parade, accompanied by tassa drumming at the end to represent Ram's triumphant march into his kingdom. Yet, while that folk form has full approval of Orthodox Hindus, there are others in which there is a tension between them and mainstream Hinduism. One finds that some of these folk practices, be they religious or not religious, do not seem to have the approval of Orthodox Hindus, and I may say middle-class Hindus. And many of them reject these things and claim that they do not exist as a part of the religion at all. Now, one such form is the Matikur or Digdoti. This is known in both Trinidad and Guyana as Matikur, but it is also called Digdoti in Guyana because it involves a puja in which a hole is dug in the earth or in the ground. Now, this folk form has a rather uneasy relationship with Orthodox mainstream Hindus, as I have said. While it is performed by the middle class do in fact perform Matikur. But theirs is a holy puja, an edited, sterile, or sterilized version of the practice. The Matikur is a wedding ritual performed on the Friday evening of the Hindu wedding, with a central role for the mother of the groom or the mother of the bride. There is tassa drumming, a procession along the street, an earth ritual, and a dance. However, the core of this ritual is what takes place in the secret performances exclusively among the women. There is very suggestive or sexually explicit dancing and cursing in irreverent language. Right? Now, this might well be the source of the class tension because of that behavior, which is regarded as vulgar and unbecoming. However, very ironically, it is a ritual of purity and chastity. What is interesting is that it is a folk dramatization based on myth. It uses the story of Ram and Sita to create ritual dramatization. Now, I had mentioned the complexity of the Ram-Sita story, and it goes on. After Sita was rescued from Lanka and brought home by Ram, there were those in the kingdom who accused her of having slept with Ravan while she was in captivity. Ram had no doubt about her innocence. But in order to stop the rumors, he allowed his wife to be put on trial, knowing her chastity would be proved. In one version of the story, Sita appealed to Mother Earth to reveal her innocence, and the goddess did that. But the goddess also chastised the people, proclaiming that Sita was too pure to live among them, and took her away from the city. The Digdoti ritual then is performed to draw on that story of the purity of Sita and to confirm the chastity of the bride. The sexual nature of the dance is supposed to be instruction for her in preparation for marriage. And the cursing is done to chastise gossipers and accusers and to dispel the slander that was practiced against Sita. This slander is cursed away to protect the bride and is another example of the literary and dramatic accuracy of these theatrical folk forms. I did mention the accuracy with which these folk forms make use of dramatization and literariness. Now, there are a number of other traditions, which I will basically cut out because of the time constraint. But they are not all associated with Hinduism. I have been talking so far about those associated with Hinduism. But there are those similar rituals which come from Islam. For example, the Hosay tradition, which is a kind of a commemoration of the martyrdom of Hassan and Hussein. Now, this has its origin in the succession problem, the problem of succession that took place after the death of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, on whom be peace. There was no official successor to Muhammad, and there were two factions of Muslims who fought over the succession, the Sunnis and the Shiites. One group believing that he should be succeeded by his grandson, the other group believing that they should have an election for a successor. They never agreed, and the whole thing turned to bitter fighting, bitter enmity, bitter wars, and in fact it led to the betrayal and the slaughter, the murder of Hassan and Hussein, the grandsons of the Prophet, peace be upon him. The Hosay tradition is a commemoration of that martyrdom. And the effigies are built to represent the tombs and to represent the mausoleum in which they were buried, and also to depict and act out the battle that took place when they were killed, and so on. And again, we find in this ritual the use of theatrical elements, the use of the carnivalesque, and the use of drama. Now, there are very interesting things about that ritual which led to its fading away in Guyana, for example. It hasn't faded away in Trinidad. And even though I have not seen it in Jamaica myself, I understand that there are traces of it there as well. But there are elements of cultural change which affected the Hosé or Taja, as it was known in Guyana, which, according to some sources, contributed to its fading away in that country. Because I am coming next to talk about cultural change. And what happened with the Taja is a very good example of cultural change and the popular culture, the role of the popular culture in all of this. Now, one informant who remembers participating in the Taja in Guyana in the 1950s described it as the greatest sport. He said, Taja was the greatest sport in Guyana. And when you look at a solemn ritual that it's supposed to be and describe it as the greatest sport in Guyana, right? Is that it attracted quite a bit of interest from non-Muslims. It is said that Hindus joined it. It is said that Africans joined it and many others who were not themselves involved in Islam. It is also said that two things happened. One was the stick fighting element of it, and the other was the introduced element of rum drinking. Rum drinking became a very important part of the Taja. And put together, the copious consumption of rum and the stick fights, and you get violence. You get something that transcends drama and gets itself into real action. And it is said that many of the Taja processions ended in a drunken brawl, which brought it into disrepute and caused it to be banned by various authorities. In Trinidad, there were similar elements which led to battles between the Hosé practitioners and the police. And in fact, there was a famous killing when several of them were killed by the police in Trinidad. And one can find accounts of it in a book published by your Center for Caribbean Studies, a book called The Bloodstained Tombs. Right? Yeah, Kevin Baldio thinks Bloodstained Tombs. So that the cultural change, I'm talking here about the fact that cultural change affected the Taja in Guyana to a very great extent, and that this cultural change also had its effect in several of these other traditions that I'm talking about. Now, there are several elements that make very interesting study in cultural differences and change. And one can take differences between the Diwali in Trinidad and in Guyana, for instance. The same festival came over from India and developed in similar ways in the two societies. It seems, however, that the involvement of the popular culture and the fringe participation, as well as the wider population, what I'm saying is that the participation in Diwali of fringe elements, the popular culture, and the wider society is greater in Guyana than it has been in Trinidad. That impact is more pronounced in Guyana. And it has led to a great deal of revelry on Diwali night, so that the Diwali exhibitions are finished and the fets take over. And they have street parties and a lot of revelry that take place after the Diwali ritual. And of course, the ubiquitous rum drinking. Right? Now, these are all parts of the kind of cultural change, because the cultural scene that exists in Guyana at the present time, coming out of on Diwali night, could never have been imagined by any holy practitioner of Hinduism. And in fact, it has caused some embarrassment in Georgetown, in particular, a place called Alexander Village, where the behavior by any standards is outrageous and indefensible, the behavior of the revelers. And it has caused conflict in that society. Now, and given the nature of Guyana, if one knows anything about Guyana, one knows that everything in Guyana turns into race politics. So that even this element of riotous behavior has turned into race politics in Guyana, where some of the Hindus believe that the black violators who take part in this revelry are attacking the religion, that they are attacking Hinduism, and that they are attacking the Indians. And so one gets that feeling coming out, but that is not accurate. These people have no interest whatsoever in Hinduism. Indians may be there or they may not be there. They are out for revelry. They are out for fun, as they see it. And so that I am not convinced that what ends up as an attack on sacred practices have nothing at all to do with religion or race. Now, the other element I want to talk about, Now, other elements of the Diwali, in terms of differences between Trinidad and Guyana, have to do with the public exhibitions of tableaux depicting Hindu deities are larger and more intricately designed and built in Trinidad. This may well be a factor of Trinidad's superior craft in costume building and the continued experience of Ram Leela. Ram Leela takes place just barely a month or so before Diwali. Yet, this element has gained some ground in Guyana. While the motorcade in Georgetown used to be dominated by lights, more floats today depict tableaux with large, spectacular, intricately crafted images of Lakshmi, Krishna, and other deities like those in Trinidad. And this is another element of the change that has been taking place in Guyana. Still, in the area of craft and its tradition, an outstanding feature in Trinidad is the use of bamboo. Bamboo is much more widely used in that country as part of the tableau and to enhance the display of lights. Now, there is an art in the splitting and bending of bamboo to form magnificent arches on which diyas are placed. This is a practice in Trinidad much more than it is in Guyana. Now, I'm going to have to basically tone down because I think I'm running outrageously out of time. I was going to go on to talk about other elements of cultural change and other elements of the popular culture and the role that they play in all of these, such as what has happened. There are several differences, for example, between what takes place in rural Guyana and what takes place in urban Guyana in Diwali, and the kinds of preservation of old traditions in the rural areas rather than in the urban. I wanted to talk about the drumming traditions and the closeness between Indian drumming and Indian traditional ritual and practice, and the closeness between all of these and religion, as I have mentioned before, and the fact that religion drives the performing arts in these countries where as far as Indian culture is concerned. I am just going to, having mentioned those, the another element that I would have wanted to talk about too is the chutney, the development of the chutney from Bhojpuri, the kind of way in which the chutney moved from rural folk practice in both Guyana and Trinidad to a part of the urban culture, a part of the popular culture and the popular music of these countries, the content of the Bhojpuri songs, the kind of devotion that the chutney singers pay to rum drinking, and the kind of relationships that take place in the chutney songs, the sexuality, the increasing sexuality in the songs, among several other things, the gender issue, and the fact that Bhojpuri itself from India is a form that has a lot to do with gender issues, that has a lot to do with male-female relationships, and has a lot to do with the very things that were at the root of Bhojpuri, which had basically gone out of it, but which are now reasserting themselves in various forms of the popular culture. I want to just end by saying that one of the things that delayed the development of novels about Indian life and Indian culture in Guyana was the look to Mother India in the early part of the 20th century and the neglect of local Indian life. But at the same time, linked to that is the kind of middle class disparagement of folk forms and folk practices, which have a lot to do with what was taking place in Indian life in Guyana, because particularly during indentureship and after indentureship, at the time when the Indian population was seeking an identity, when they were trying to solidify themselves as Indian people or as people of Indian culture, they were looking to Mother India and not to these kind of forms in Guyana, which some of them might have considered infradig, right? But the neglect of that, which still exists in the attitudes to sexuality, the attitudes to elements of the popular or folk culture in these Indian traditions. And that, however, in looking at these traditional Indian practices and theatrical Indian practices, we're looking at traditions which are driven by religion, traditions which have sustained the performing arts, because dance and music are crucial elements of the spread of Hinduism. And that these traditions are very precise, intense employers of myth, symbolism, drama, and theater. Thank you.